chair temporarily, vice chair of this committee, chair this morning for the informational meeting on Alzheimer's disease of the House Committee on Health and Human Services today on February 18th, 2005. Thank you all for coming. Some of you realize that I live in Milwaukee and I'm staying here in Salem with the wonderful family of Kate and Lee, senior moment, Lee Walker, who have agreed to share their wonderful home with me. And I got to know them about a year and a half ago, and I was so delighted to be able to come back and live in the same home. And I've watched Lee with Alzheimer's disease, and I've watched Kate living with Alzheimer's disease. And so we talked about how we can make the public more aware of this disease. I learned more in these few weeks with Kate and Lee than I'd ever known in all of my many years of living. So I appreciate all of you coming here and sharing your information and your stories with us. So thank you, and thanks to the committee for being here this morning. First, we're going to be hearing from Dr. Quinn and Georgine, is that correct? Simpson and Judy McClellar. And please, for the record, would you identify yourselves as you begin to speak so that that will be on the record.
Okay. I'm Joe Quinn, and I'm a neurologist at OHSU and at the VA. And I work at the Alzheimer's Center of Oregon. And I'm going to, I guess, introduce the topic, and I thought I would say a few words about definitions to sort of clarify what it is we're talking about when we say Alzheimer's disease, and then talk about the physician's role, which regrettably is relatively circumscribed, and then open up the discussion to these other folks who have come to tell us about the number of different people that need to be involved in the care of patients with Alzheimer's disease. So to start with definitions, people always ask me, well, what's the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia? What's the difference between Alzheimer's disease and senility? Isn't this what we used to call senility? And I'll start off by describing what dementia is. Dementia is any acquired brain condition that injures the brain to such a degree that a person can't think clearly enough to carry out everyday activities. So dementia is a relatively broad term. And there are a number of different causes of dementia. You can have multiple strokes causing dementia. You can have metabolic conditions causing dementia. You can have infections causing dementia. But far and away, the most common cause of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. And it's true that we hear a lot more about Alzheimer's disease than we used to in the past, and it's true that we used to call this condition senility, but it's become more appreciated that it's actually a disease process. And when we say that a patient has Alzheimer's disease, we're inferring that the brain is actually infiltrated by a disease process. There are these plaques deposited between the brain cells in the brain. There are other deposits inside of the brain cells themselves. And over time, the brain cells die, and the patient loses function as a result of that. So in the clinic, when we have patients come to us with memory complaints, the evaluation consists of a careful history to learn how the process has evolved and what the manifestations are, followed by a physical examination that in this case includes a mental status examination. And at the conclusion of that period of time, we are able to make a clinical diagnosis of a dementia or not, of this broad syndrome of a dementia. The next step is to determine, well, is this dementia due to Alzheimer's disease or to some other process? And that usually involves doing a brain scan and doing some blood tests. It turns out we don't have a gold standard for the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. We don't have a test that can tell us that a person for sure has the disease. There's some misunderstanding surrounding that with respect to PET scans and some other things that are inappropriately touted as gold standards. But it's really a clinical diagnosis made by the physician. And when it's made in a careful manner, it's actually a pretty reliable diagnosis. The diagnosis can't be confirmed until autopsy, but when it is evaluated at autopsy, these clinical diagnoses are confirmed 90% of the time. So that's the diagnostic evaluation, which is the first role of the physician. And then the question is, what can be done medically to treat the disease? And it turns out that there are four drugs approved by the FDA right now for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. And while that's an improvement over the situation a decade ago when none of these drugs were approved, the drugs are only modestly effective. These are drugs that have modest effects on symptoms. Three of them are all in the same class, and the fourth is in a separate class. So you don't put people on all four drugs. You can have them on one drug out of the class of three. You can potentially combine that with the other drug. But again, the effects on the disease are pretty modest. And the cost of the drugs are not insignificant. The drug's retail rate will run $120 to $150 a month. If you have them on two drugs, then you're doubling the cost of therapy. Now, is that worth it or not? That's really not a black and white scientific or medical decision. It's really a value judgment. How much value do you put on some more attention, some more memory, maybe some more time? These are very difficult decisions. So in terms of sort of the traditional physician's role, it's relatively circumscribed in Alzheimer's disease. We can make a diagnosis, we can treat symptoms, we can use some of these drugs that are currently available, but we don't have a lot to offer in terms of conventional medicine right now. And some of us at OHSU and elsewhere comfort ourselves by doing research, trying to look to the future, trying to develop other therapies. And the reality is there's reason for optimism. I think we're going to have some more substantial therapies in the coming decades, which is going to be timely because the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease is going to continue to explode. But in the meantime, we've got an awful lot of patients that are already afflicted here in the state of Oregon, and the care of those patients really goes beyond what a physician can do to involve nursing care, social worker care, lay people who are caregivers and advocates, and that's what the balance of the speakers I think are going to describe for us, and I will turn it over to Georgine Simpson, who's a nurse practitioner working at our center and specializes in family care issues.
Colleagues, I'm going to ask that we hold our questions to the end, but I'm going to take the chair's privilege and ask a quick question. Dr. Quinn, you said that the incidence of Alzheimer's will explode in the coming years. Could you explain that briefly?
Yes. Alzheimer's disease is an age-dependent phenomenon, which sounds trivial to say, but the age dependence is really quite dramatic. Between the age of 65 and 75, the prevalence is 1 to 2% of the population. 75 to 85, it's 10 to 15% of the population. Over the age of 85, it's 40 to 50% of the population. So as the population ages, the numbers just explode, and that's why this is really a looming public health crisis.
That's terrifying. Thank you, Dr. Quinn. Please identify yourself, Georgine.
I'm Georgine Simpson, and I'm a geriatric nurse practitioner at the OHSU Layton Alzheimer's Research Center. And the role of the nurse is not quite as circumscribed or defined or specific in, with the care of patients with Alzheimer's disease and their families' needs. My experience has been along the continuum of care, and what I mean is from the home setting to hospitalizations, hospital setting, long-term care, assisted living, and I've done primary care in a geriatric internal medicine clinic. So I bring experience that the gamut of the levels of care through the, what we call the continuum. And I think this is very valuable because that in itself leads complexity to the situation of what families need. When I get involved with a family, I do an assessment of the situation, which involves the family's function. How do they do the work of the family? What are their relationship? Who is within the family? Alzheimer's disease, depending on where a person lives and how the disease affects them, has a gamut of what the needs of that particular situation are. Not everyone responds the same way to the disease process. each individual brings their own background, their own other medical problems, and their own belief system about health to the disease experience and what happens for them. In addition to that, it affects the family. When we think about Alzheimer's disease, it is most commonly seen in person in the older age group. But another reality is that in rare situations, younger persons may also be affected. So persons now that in hopefully more and more cases, the presence of Alzheimer's disease is identified earlier in the disease process. We are identifying persons who may, in the early stages, still be employed, still be active with volunteer work, and have adaptations to do in complex social situations. And so the importance of early identification is important. So in looking at each individual situation, it is helpful for a professional who has had experience in training with working with families, with counseling, as well as assessing response to treatment, are all important areas that need to be brought to the family, as well as, I call that the informal support system. The informal support system is the family, friends, perhaps even the employer who may adapt a job situation for someone who is affected. But then there is also not only teaching and counseling within the family. The nurse has a role in teaching formal caregivers. And so even in other settings, such as long-term care, assisted living, or adult foster care, there's a critical need for teaching coping strategies and also symptom management that may happen as the disease progresses. This kind of support at the lowest level of care, most persons with Alzheimer's disease are cared for in the home setting. This is what families want, and this is also looking at the healthcare system, of course, more cost-effective for the family as well as the healthcare system. The kinds of support that families and their caregivers need in the home setting involves not different types of information and resources. One is information, having the availability of learning about Alzheimer's disease, learning about what's available in the community, learning about what support groups are there. Research has shown that the availability of those kinds of services are critical to maintain family integrity. And by family, I use that term very broadly. May not even be related family, but who's there involved in the care of the person. But then there is also very interesting that I've seen in the literature is, and I have found in my own experience, that families also need one-on-one demonstration and one-on-one problem solving for their particular situation, because each individual is unique in how the symptoms present themselves. There may be emotional symptoms. There may be symptoms on how someone acts. There may be a difference on how someone responds to particular medications. The treatments Dr. Quinn had explained regarding the four medications that are available. Medications come into this in other ways as well, because many times people don't only have Alzheimer's disease. They may have other illnesses, what we may call comorbidities. These complicate the situation. So involvement of a geriatric nurse practitioner is helpful to help tease out what can best meet the needs of that individual. Also, medications for some symptoms, behavioral symptoms as an example, or part of someone may experience symptoms of disrupted sleep, which is very common. Medications may not be the best answer. For someone in the older age group, they're much more sensitive to medications because they're used differently within the body. We call that the metabolism of the drugs or the pharmacokinetics. So they're much more sensitive. So in monitoring that and teaching and helping problem solve, environmental interventions is very important. A nurse cannot do everything. The skill set is not there to do everything. There are referrals that are done as the patient and family need them. And the nurse can make referrals for occupational therapy, physical therapy. And these are skilled services, and depending on the type of insurance that someone has, where they live, the availability of resources are very different. The one study I found that talked about the use of formal versus informal resources, formal being medical providers, social service agencies, such as that, informal being family, it seems logical, but that persons in a more metropolitan area, such as Portland, have more access to formal support systems, and in the rural areas, the informal support system is much more involved with much fewer resources, but experiencing the same needs as families who have them available to them. So in closure, I think this summarizes really nicely what I want to say. It's actually a paraphrase I'm taking from Referee Journal, Healthcare Nurse, a study done in 1991. The caregiver and person with Alzheimer's disease needs an advocate who is concerned about their well-being. The nurse or skilled professional can fulfill this role by treating the needs of the caregiver as well as the dependent person. Advancing community programs to reverse the caregiver burden and supporting legislation that recognizes that older persons cannot be the sole caregiver to their dependent loved one.
Thank you, Georgine. Judy.
I'm Judy McKellar. I'm the Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association for the State of Oregon and Clark County, Washington. I was looking at a family picture the other day, and I was a baby sitting on my great-grandmother's lap, and my mother and my grandmother were behind us. I'm the only female in that picture who hasn't died of Alzheimer's. I lost two parents, two grandparents, and two great-grandparents to this disease. And we get calls in our organization from thousands of families asking our help. So we provide services that include a helpline. It's a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week helpline, so that people, when they're in crisis, the family members that you were talking about, reach out for help. We can reach back and give them information about local resources, steps they need to take to move forward with their family in this disease. We can just hear the pain because the caregivers become overwhelmed. I was a caregiver for a couple generations in my family. And I know that it becomes huge in terms of how do I function in my life and how do I care for aging parents. And these are the kinds of calls we get from, as I said, thousands of families. We have a Getting Started program, which helps people when they have been newly diagnosed so that they have an opportunity to find out information about what's ahead of them, what do they need to do, what things do they need to get in place so that they will be able to have an easier time on their journey, because it's all kinds of things that we don't expect or think about that have to be done pretty early, because the ability to function with Alzheimer's and make rational decisions goes away as the disease progresses. We have a Safe Return program. It's a national program that registers people who want to be registered in it so that they can be returned to their safe place and they wander This also has a 24-hour day, 7-day-a-week contact center in Chicago that is our national headquarters. 60% of people who have dementia do wander, and it's very dangerous, so they can be returned. And we have over 98% success rate in returning people because of this program. We hold over 117 support groups that are scattered throughout the state of Oregon and in the Clark County area. And these can be specialized groups that deal with adult children. They may deal with male caregivers because predominantly caregiving is done by women. And we sometimes focus on early onset. That's a different situation. And early stage, late stage, different types of groups that are specific to the needs of the people who call in who need our help. We hold a lot of education programs because one of the tools that helps families the most is understanding of what they're dealing with, understanding of what it is, so that when people behave in challenging ways because of this illness, if we understand it is because the brain is being destroyed rather than this person is just being ornery, it helps people when they get educated so that they can have less stress. It's a very stressful journey. We also combine our efforts and work with OHSU on physician outreach. And on the statistics that you asked about previously, there are about 4.5 million people in the United States who have this, approximately 76,000 in the state of Oregon. And because of our demographics in this state, that will be increasing by 93% actually within the next 20 years. We had a woman who took one of our educational classes, and she literally was suicidal when she came. And fortunately, we were able to provide her with some information that gave her some hope. And when she left, she said, "Thank you, I feel like I can breathe now, not just sigh." So we're looking for all the help we can get to help other families be able to breathe, not just sigh. Thank you
so much, Judy. Colleagues, again, I'm exercising chair privilege by allowing questions. As I was thinking this through, as we're getting so many people up here, it's going to be difficult to ask questions at the end. So if you have any brief questions of at least these two folks, and we can also bring Dr. Quinn up, please feel free to let me know. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a question for Dr. Quinn, but I think probably Georgine might be able to answer it as well. Judy, you said one thing that family members had died from Alzheimer's. Out of 100 patients, Alzheimer's patients, how many will die from what kinds of diseases? Do you die from Alzheimer's?
Dr. Quinn, could you come up? Yes, again, announce who you are.
So people do die with Alzheimer's disease, and when you die, when death is attributed to Alzheimer's disease, it's usually because the patient becomes so disabled that they develop an infection or an illness that they otherwise wouldn't have gotten. Another common cause of death in patients with Alzheimer's disease that's due to the Alzheimer's disease itself is that people stop eating, stop taking nutrients, and we refer to that as inanition. And I would say that infection and inanition are the two leading causes of death. Alzheimer's disease does hasten mortality. It is considered a cause of mortality, and in fact is one of the leading causes of mortality.
So out of out of 100 patients, the majority of them would die from either infection or inanition.
The majority would, and then some of them will die of other age-related illnesses like heart attacks and strokes and so on.
Follow-up then, relative to a treatment regimen and protocol, what at some point these medications at $120 to $150 a month because of the other related issues, is there some kind of a regimen that you stop at some point and say there's a termination to it, or do they take their medicines right to the day that they...
No, we usually recommend that as people reach the later stages of the disease, when there's just not enough sort of brain substrate to respond to the medications, we will usually withdraw them from the... There's not a it's not a discrete line that we draw, but the idea is that there are later stages in the disease where the medications are not playing much of a role. So maybe I should add that the average duration, and Alzheimer's disease is very heterogeneous, there's a lot of variability, but the average duration from diagnosis until death is 8 to 10 years. That's a long time, and in these early phases, as Georgine was saying, some people are still working if they're young enough, some people are really enjoying a very high quality of life. In the later stages, some patients are vegetative.
And then another question, Madam Chair. Hereditary tendencies, Judy indicated that lots of family.
That's right, and this is always a tough one to answer. So it turns out that if you take all the if you took those 100 patients with Alzheimer's disease, none of them would be likely to have a gene that caused Alzheimer's disease. So it's a very small fraction of patients with Alzheimer's disease who have genes that are known to cause Alzheimer's disease, and there are some rare families that have what's called autosomal dominant Alzheimer's disease. They're exceedingly rare. There are other genes that have been implicated as risk factors. They don't cause the disease, but they shift the risk one way or another. And the best established of these, to give you a sense of what we know about genetics, is if you round up 100 patients with Alzheimer's disease, 45 of them will have a high-risk gene. If you round up 100 matched people who don't have Alzheimer's disease, 15 of them will have that gene. And there's this discordance, 45% to 15%, that consistently shows up in these studies that have been conducted over the last decade. So it shows that that gene is a risk factor, but it also shows that half the patients with Alzheimer's disease don't have the gene. 15% of the normal population have the gene. So I'm giving you a very complicated story in a nutshell here, but that's it.
Thank you. Madam Chair, there was one other comment that was made relative to symptom management, that's a term. I'm an accountant, and symptoms are when it doesn't balance at the bottom. So what's
the similar.
Okay. Yeah. So symptoms can be apathy, depression, agitation, delusions, hallucinations, and anxiety, sleep disturbance. The list can go on and on. And as Georgine was pointing out, we can treat some of these symptoms with sort of environmental manipulations, and we can treat some of these symptoms with medications, and some of these symptoms we can't treat at all. So it's different from curing pneumonia or curing hypertension. We're attacking symptoms. That doesn't mean that it's not worth doing. It's just a different model of treatment.
Certainly. And finally, Madam Chair, if I may, it was mentioned some kinds of monitoring, national monitoring, to find those that may wander. And I'm wondering if there are electronic monitors. I mean, technology is moving so fast that there could be implementation of electronic monitoring so that nationally, or at least within the state or a region where we have a number of Alzheimer's patients, that perhaps monitoring could be one way to assist in making sure that those folks are active, that they're not sedentary full time, or that if they do tend to wander, that we would be able to monitor where they're at. And I would like to at some point explore the possibility of using Oregon's high technology database. And I know that through the Oregon Health and Sciences, particularly the opportunity grant that we have with the Health and Sciences University, that this is one of the areas that we could implement some of the high tech areas and issues to address potentially the work that is being done at the university and that Dr. Quinn has referred to.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Boone.
I just had a quick question for Dr. Quinn. He said that Alzheimer's can be determined only after autopsy, that there's different dementia. Does dementia overlay it, and Alzheimer's is one of?
Yeah, I apologize for not making that clear. So dementia is a broad term, mm-hmm. and Alzheimer's disease is one type of dementia. So a person who has Alzheimer's disease has both dementia and Alzheimer's disease.
Okay. So how do you determine what you treat? How do you treat it, or you treat the machine?
How do we? So we make the diagnosis when a patient has a slowly progressive dementia that starts with memory problems and then generalizes to other thinking problems, and when that person's brain scan does not show us multiple strokes or other causes of the dementia, and when the patient's blood tests don't show us metabolic causes of dementia. that's when we make a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And I think that's really unsettling for patients and families that we don't have a gold standard test to offer them. And what I always remind people is that when we do look for autopsy confirmation, it's confirmed 90% of the time. And when I've looked at the details of those studies, and the other 10% tend to be obscure neurodegenerative diseases. They're not reversible conditions. They're not necessarily Alzheimer's disease, but they're other progressive neurodegenerative diseases.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Greenlee.
Madam Chair, just comment. You meant more properly, Alzheimer's is one of the is one of the causes of dementia, not one of the forms of dementia, I think. One of the reasons we hold these kind of hearings is for information purposes, just to educate us. But one of the other reasons is we're always looking for things that require legislative action. And I've been involved in two of the major projects, three if we include the Department of Neurology's work that I was involved in, dealing with home and community-based long-term care, and particularly with services, support services for the caregivers themselves, both the social HMO for over 20 years and the PrEP project, the School of Nursing, which may be what you were, I think you may have been quoting that article, but PrEP has been very much involved in that. Health insurance defines the notion of care as paying for care for the patient. And one of the things that the PrEP study has made so clear is that providing essentially medical care services, particularly nursing support coordination and skilled nursing support services for the caregiver, has very important functions, because we depend, I think as you pointed out, 80% of the care is informal and only 20% is formal. Do you sense we need to do more? Have you sensed the folks you deal with in the support groups need more aggressive services relating to their own health and their own ability to care for the people for which they care, that isn't covered by health insurance or isn't included in the existing medical care system? And might there be something we can do about that? Is that an issue?
It's extremely challenging physically, emotionally, mentally, to care for people with Alzheimer's, and the stress is high. And we find that people who are doing this caregiving 24/7 in their homes, their health suffers. If a lot of families that call in don't have money to pay for respite, they don't have enough family and friend involvement to let them have time out. So when this takes a 24/7 toll on them, it's very expensive to their health. I know my dad's Alzheimer's was and process of dying was speeded up by caring for my mother. My mother had it over 20 years, my dad over 10. So a lot of families don't understand that this isn't just covered some way, that they can't get coverage for their loved one who has the disease and for themselves and some of the, you know, respite and things like that. And they don't understand that if they don't have long-term care, they don't have money to cover this illness and getting help every day. So it takes a huge toll.
If I may follow that.
Please.
Well, one of the things my two colleagues in the School of Nursing, Todd Archibald and Barbara Stewart, have found in this is that the issue isn't only making sure there's respite and other kind of services, but that a skilled nursing service can teach a caregiver what they need to do to make caregiving less stressful and less and more rewarding, in fact.
Right.
But there's no way to pay for that in terms of current health insurance models, because while we can give care to the Alzheimer's patient, we can't provide health services specifically for the caregiver that would make them more effective caregivers. And it seems to me that's one of the things you might find very much more useful, and we may have to look at how we can make health insurance responsive to the needs of the caregiver, because the caregiver is saving us enormous money and doing things a lot better than we could do entirely.
And actually 70% of caregiving is done by family and friends. And you're right. And when we also do education to teach them how to communicate and cut down on challenging behaviors, but they need help. You're so right. You're so right on. They need help.
Thank you very much, Representative Greenlee. You bring up a great point, and I think that was one of the reasons to have this informational hearing, so we know what the problems are and where maybe the legislature can be moving. And speaking of moving, we need to move on, but I know
Representative Anderson.
Anderson, thank you. My senior moment is coming back. Period.
It's early. Dr. Quinn, I had a question. I apologize for missing testimony early this morning, but did you cover, and if you have, I'll take the testimony later, but any of the present and future medications that are being developed, any that are in trial?
I talked about the limitations of the presently available medications, and I alluded to the fact that we're working hard to bring some more through the pipeline. Did you want to hear any specifics about that?
There are several out there, I think, maybe in trial. Aricept.
So Aricept is approved, Reminyl is approved, Exelon is approved, and Namenda is approved. There's a whole host of strategies underway with drugs that are in clinical trials or on the verge of being in clinical trials with more, I think, substantial possibilities for affecting the natural history of the disease. And then there's some other things further sort of up the pipeline that they need to have the preclinical work done before they'll come to clinical trials. But there's nothing that's going to be approved in the next 6 to 12 months that's going to make a dramatic difference. And, you know, my feeling is we really need to be working on research at the same time that we're working on the ideas that Representative Greenlee was just describing, and better ways to take care of these people now.
Great. Thank you.
Great. Please state who you are.
Hi, I'm Holly Crown, and I'll try to hurry because I want Kathy to be able to talk about her caregiving experience. Currently, I have the privilege of coordinating a respite program for people with Alzheimer's and other dementia, and get to have great exchanges of socialization with folks who have Alzheimer's, but also work with the families who are the direct caregivers. And they do need a lot of support and services. And I also work with the Alzheimer's Network of Oregon, which is a local nonprofit organization that provides services and supports and outreach to families. One of the really important things that's already been touched on, so I won't go into detail, but education, early education is very important. So one of the programs that we do is an early stage program that helps educate not only the person with Alzheimer's disease, but also the family about, you know, how to plan and how to take care of themselves so they can be a better caregiver. One of the important things that you touched on about the legislation that was passed in 2000, the Family Caregiver Support Program, which was one of the first legislations passed that provides funds and supports for the family caregiver. I think that that's was a wonderful first step, and I think it does need to be increased, because what we find is that the care is expensive, and when the caregiver tries to say, well, I need to take care of myself, but I don't have any money left to take care of myself, though there are some limited resources out there for the family caregiver, but they need to be increased, because once those run out, then they're left again with, you know, the burden of the care. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Holly. Could you please, for the record, state who you are?
Yes. I'm Kathy Alcott, and I'm a caregiver for my husband. I hope you'll forgive me for using paper. I'm a novice at this. Most caregivers are too old to be caregivers. It's a 7-day a week, 24-hour a day job. It just creeps up on us a little at a time as we see our mate start to deteriorate, both mentally and physically. My husband was a geologist, and he was a very strong, independent man. But now, I bib him, I bathe him, I diaper him, I dress him, I pick him up when he falls. I have to even speak for him. He must be monitored constantly to see what he's up to, like a two-year-old. If you hear silence from another room for more than 2 minutes, you have to go and check to see what's going on. I'm his mother, his nurse, a psychologist, the bookkeeper, the chambermaid who cleans up the unpleasant bathroom mishaps, the cook, a housekeeper, a chauffeur, a gardener, a babysitter, and a legal representative with power of attorney to handle our legal and financial matters. We caregivers are responsible for everything that happens inside and outside our houses. Many caregivers have to put up with violence as well. Caregivers, as well as patients, often deal with other diseases as well. Arthritis, diabetes, heart problems, some quite debilitating. At our house, my husband must be on oxygen. So we now have 50 feet of plastic tubing weaving its way through our little retirement home, and that is determined to trip us at every state. And my husband walks with a walker, and we just get tangled up all the time. When he's out with his portable oxygen, I feel like Cinderella. I have to get him home in 4 hours before the oxygen runs out and our golden pumpkin disappears. That's just the way I feel. We had a lovely family Christmas, and that night I was up with him 6 times to help him at the commode. At 3 o'clock in the morning, he tipped over his commode with all its contents all over his bedroom floor. And when he went to get back into bed, he lurched into bed and suddenly disappeared. It was almost funny. I went around the bed and he was wedged between the bed and the wall. I stood there among all that chaos and filth, and I started to laugh. And I thought, it's either that or Center Street for me. I always woke and do still wake at every sound from his bedroom. But I was up with him several times one night and then apparently fell into too deep a sleep to hear his escape from the house. And I woke a half hour later and found him in the hedge around our house, face down, pinned immobile on the thorns and the sharp twigs of the hedge. And he'd been there a half an hour in a 37 degree temperature with just his pajamas on and crying out for help, and nobody heard him. And so the wonderful man from 911 came and took him to the hospital to stitch him up from his cuts. And one of the cuts is a 4.5-inch slice clear across his arm and gouges. And it was there at the hospital that I finally just hit the wall, and I knew that I couldn't go on, even if it meant putting him in a nursing home. But the social worker at the hospital, she even dialed the number for me, called Senior Services, and they gave me such quick, caring, practical support that it's been most helpful. It not only takes a village to raise a child, it takes a village to take care of the elderly and disabled and those with dementia and those who care for them. Alzheimer's and other dementia patients are increasing in numbers, and when a nursing home is the only recourse, it will cost all of us a great deal more than support services at home. With the aid from social services, I no longer have an impossible job, and my husband is still at home. I wish to honor all caregivers, and I trust that with your budgetary assistance, we can be reassured that we won't have to do the impossible alone.
Thank you so much. Wait for a moment if we have any questions. I have a question. How old is your husband?
He's 89 now.
And how old are you?
I'm 79.
Okay. And how long have you been caring for him without him?
Just like I said, it just crept up. But it says in here 8 years. It's been that or longer. But it came so gradually that it was hardly, you know, I just took over one additional thing at a time as he failed at things. And you just pick up and do it for him. And so it's been a long, long time.
Yeah.
It's also isolating. It isolates us from a lot of the community because who wants to go visit somebody with Alzheimer's disease? And we can't go out often. And so we, in that way, become isolated.
I can see that. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Thank you for your testimony. That's very touching. I watched my mom go 10 years through Alzheimer's, and it's very, very disheartening to see a person who's very, very sharp and a terrific reader get to the place where they can't even communicate with sons and daughters. Tell me how much time you have help at home and how much time you spend.
Okay. Well, I live with him 24 hours a day except through the support services through Human Services. I'm now taking a class in further caregiving and they will reimburse me for that class. I have had, as a result of that last trip to the hospital, when I couldn't do it anymore, I got a night person, and I got that name through the Senior Services Division. They have lists of people that they have already investigated for their background so that they're not criminal or anything of that nature. And then we have to make the contacts and the interviews with those people. And now I have what I call the lady of the night. She comes at 11 at night, and she leaves at 7 in the morning, which are terrible hours for most of us. But just so she enjoys coming, and so she spends a night. I pay her $45 a night, and which is very reasonable. She's not a professional, though she has given care in her past. So I have a friend who comes in 2 hours a week now, so I can get an errand done. I did my advance directive yesterday on that, and I've got two women who I hope between the two of them will be able to come and sit with him so I can go to a concert or the Pinnacle or something like that. But we're fortunate because we can afford it because those services are not free. And so those caregivers who don't have money to pay for a night person, for example, I can go in my bedroom. I was not sleeping. I had that problem anyway. I just had sort of just quit sleeping and was listening for a sound, a pin drop anywhere. And so now I can go in at 11 and close the door to my room and sometimes sleep the whole night.
Good. That's wonderful. Of course.
So you do have some respite care.
Yes, I'm
fortunate. Do you personally have health insurance for yourself?
I have long-term care for me, but I figured I'd be here to take care of my husband, so we don't have that kind of insurance for him.
But do you have medical insurance for yourself?
We have Kaiser Permanente, but there are no services for us through that,
right,
other than our doctor.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Greenley.
Yes, you ought to think now and say on the Healthcare Advantage 2 that would give you services.
Pardon, I'm sorry.
I'll talk to you after. I sat on the governor's work group on the health budget with a bipartisan group, and one of the things that's very clear is we will be cutting, the governor's budget reduces the money available for long-term care services. And this story is so moving, and we all need to hear these stories over and over, and because as we think about budget cuts this time when we're talking about cutting long-term care services, what we're talking about is taking away that lifeline that we offer through these services to having, and you've done a very important service to us by putting a human face on what the kind of even meager services that we provide for folks in your situation, and it's very important for us, for me who sat there worrying about budget, but also knowing it basically, I mean, it literally means life and death support for people like you.
That's right.
Something that's, I think you provided a wonderful service by being with us today to tell us this story.
Thank you, Representative Greeny. I agree totally. Thank you so much, Mrs. Alcott. Any more questions for Mrs. Alcott? Thank you so much. Dr. Quinn is coming up now with Don Bray.
We thought it would be appropriate to let a patient actually have the last word. So,
and Dr. Quinn, could you announce again who you are?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm Joe Quinn. I'm a neurologist at OHSU. And Dr. Bray is a patient of mine who has very graciously agreed to come here. And this is my first time in a setting like this, but Dr. Bray is actually a pro at this sort of thing. And maybe you could tell the committee a little bit about your career in public psychiatry.
I, like most people with Alzheimer's, I don't remember very clearly. And so as having Alzheimer's, I go very slowly, which is very frustrating. And I find that I chug along, but I have Becky who takes care of me, but in a way that I'm not aware that I'm being taken care of, because we're always doing things that are enjoyable, and she has a plan for taking a trip, driving someplace, seeing something that's going on, going visit some good friends who are here today, see what's happening in the world. So that for me, I keep chugging along in that way. And as I've been sitting here, I realize I'm not going to remember everything, and I'm probably ought to write something.
You're doing just fine. And we really appreciate your presence here. And what I sort of wanted to emphasize to the committee a little bit was that Dr. Bray was formerly the director of the Department of Mental Health here in the state of Oregon, as well as
in this place.
He's very used to this circumstance. We've had these discussions about how fortunate you feel with the wonderful support of your wife and friends and family, but you've shared with me your concerns about what you see happening to some other patients with this condition. Would you like to share that with the committee a little bit?
Yeah, the thing that bothers me most is. And I made some notes. We were trying to remember. Pardon me for this, but you feel like you're going to be invisible to people because they won't recognize who you are or know what's going on, and that you might be ignored. That people are not going to pay attention to you anymore, and that happens because I think once people learn there's this Alzheimer's guy, they back off, or tend to back off. No, I'm not used to that because it's I'm used to having friends and people come. So that's everybody needs a helper, and I got more than one helper. I've got good helpers who stay with me and go with it and I have situations that are complicated and difficult, and I like to deal with those, and I'm still able to sometimes now, and still able, and I'm, but as I recognize this process is going to, I think it won't, and I used to have this belief that if I think it won't, it won't, that it's not going to get me down, that I'll hang in here. So that's where I am, and I'm, pardon me for looking at things, but I don't remember anything. That's my problem. I've already said some of this. What's it like to live with Alzheimer's? One of the things is everybody else goes too fast. I can't slow down, and it's nice when people slow down and say, well, let's go. I can't read too well either. I got a little visual problem. I can't keep up with some things that are being said, things that are going on. I could keep up with this today. I followed this very well, and obviously it's something I'm kind of interested in. I'm just sort of one thing that I've insisted on is I can't drive the car anymore, and I decided not to drive the car anymore because I don't trust me driving the car anymore, and I think there are probably a lot of people who would keep driving the car, and people have told me that I probably could still drive the car. And people who ride in the car with me, because I'm very cautious fellow, and I like to make sure that everything is okay. But each time people encourage me to go ahead and drive the car, I say, well, I don't feel comfortable driving the car with Becky in it, because I don't want to run this car into something and be the responsible for that. And that's that. So I don't drive the car, but I'm still there thinking about it. It's interesting because as she drives the car, I'm always thinking, wait a minute, here's something's coming down here. it must be awful for her, but I talk a lot. I talk a lot, but I... So it's there's no getting it right all ever. Now I can't remember what this... Don't... Oh, I don't remember my grandchildren. I've got 6 children, and I remembered them because I decided when I got Alzheimer's, I'm not ever going to remember Chris, Ann, Kathy, Jamie, Dilly's, or Jim. Those are my children, and I will not forget. So I've gotten some things that I'm going to remember, and that's going to be my memory, and that's going to be what goes, and that's why I've done that. I hear you're stuck with an Alzheimer's guy because I can't remember what I was starting off to think about, and which is a problem with that. Now, is there something else on here that I can't remember? Oh, I used to sail a boat. That was my favorite thing. I had a sailboat, and I loved to sail it all up and down the places and all over the place. And I sold that boat because I felt I was a danger to people riding in the boat with me, and I was the one that was a sailor, and I had started with small boats and built them up and had a big boat and sailed and just loved it, but I don't do it anymore. And so one of the things you have to do with Alzheimer's is stop doing some stuff you love to do. I don't even go swimming anymore, but I could swim. If I fall overboard, I think I can still swim. But at any rate, you're speaking to somebody who has Alzheimer's, and you can kind of see that. And I'm very conscious of the process as it moves on, and I would like to avoid the dangers that come with it. And I would like to try to live the best life I can with Alzheimer's. I think if I didn't have it, I'd probably still be working, because I did enjoy my work. And I can't remember with any great clearness what I did for people, but I did enjoy my work, and I think that's all I can say.
Well, that was funny and very eloquent.
Wow.
I think that's wanted you to have the last word, and you did.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brand, and Dr. Quinn, and Kathy, Becky. Any questions of either Dr. Quinn or Dr. Bray? Dr. Bray, I do have a question.
Sure.
What is the worst part of having Alzheimer's?
The worst part? But probably I haven't experienced the worst part yet.
Okay.
I mean, I think the worst part is not being able to remember.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very much with, like to be with other people, and like to talk to other people. And now I can't move enough fast enough, because all the other people move very rapidly compared to me. And so my biggest problem, I think, is that I can't. And so what I do is just hush up. And as they talk, as people are talking fast a lot, now I could follow you guys today because you're talking about something I understand. But as people talk rapidly, I'm lost, and I realize it, and I just kind of made up my mind I'll hush up. And now that, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does, and I appreciate it that you didn't hush up today, that you were very clear about your comments. Thank you very much. And I have one more question, maybe for Dr. Quinn. It seems that what we've seen today is women caregivers for men. And what is the percentage, number one, of women and men who get, what percentage of Alzheimer's patients are women, and what percentage of caregivers are women and men?
There's a disproportionate number of women affected with Alzheimer's disease, and I don't know the numbers offhand. Part of that is due to the fact that women live longer than men, but even after accounting for that, there's more women with Alzheimer's disease than men. And there are also more women caregivers than the male caregivers, even though that would be counterintuitive based on the statement I just made. And
does somebody know the statistics on that, Judy or Jean?
Okay. But there's no question about it. Women are sort of disproportionately hit from both sides by this disease.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Bray.
Thank you.
Oh,
I have a quick question.
Yes.
To Dr. Bray. My dad had, well, dementia, as much as we know, because it was only a couple of weeks. But I would look at him, and he was a very intelligent person, and I would look at him and watch him try to say something. And what I've always wanted to know and ask, I couldn't ask him because he just couldn't explain it, what it's like. And you said people seem to move too fast. Is it because you're over here and you're trying to formulate what to say, but then they're off and running, and by the time you get it in your mind how to say it, can you explain what it's like?
Yeah, and it is, because it's just like you said, you listen to something and you start thinking, well, how can I think about this and deal with this or answer this or say something funny about this or whatever. And by the time I get my head together, it's all, everybody's moved on, and that's the problem for me. And I would assume other people with Alzheimer's are faced with the same. And I know some other people with Alzheimer's, and I can kind of see it's nice to be with other people who have Alzheimer's, and I enjoy that a lot, and it's good for us to be together, because all the more people can talk about it, it's like any problem. I think any person who has an illness, it's good to be able to talk with other people who have that same illness.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I just want to say that you made a comment about you can't remember what you did for people, that you know you enjoyed your work, and I would take the liberty to say if you enjoyed your work, I'm sure that you got enough positive feedback from those people to know that you did a lot of good things. So.
Yes, I felt good. I got some good reports from people.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. We appreciate you.
Thank you very much. Just one comment and response. One question was, how long have you been using the medications to arrest the symptoms or to stop the faster progress, Dr. Bray?
I don't know, but I can answer.
2 years, yeah.
2 years.
And then you mentioned educating society about how we approach Alzheimer's patients, and I think that that's probably one of the items that I have really appreciated about this conversation today. And I'm certain that amongst the packet of information that has been provided to us, there must be information here about how we as society should be, because as Dr. Quinn has indicated, this is an increasingly serious issue within society, how we as society should be addressing the issue of how we're going to associate with, while we may not experience Alzheimer's, with those folks that are experiencing the travesty of and the difficulties of Alzheimer's. So I think that's been very educational, Madam Chair, that we do have an opportunity to examine how we are interacting and should interact, and then begin to the education process. It's not just for the Alzheimer's patients or the Alzheimer's caregivers, but it's incumbent, I think, where this is more a part of society as society ages, that we learn how we're going to have to interact and respond and to be more compassionate. And I sincerely appreciate Dr. Bray coming, Ms. Alcott coming, and putting a real face to these issues, because it's demonstrative of the fact that you're real people, and we've got to assimilate in society how we're going to respond to the issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A lot can be said, Representative Butler. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And I'd just like to thank you, all of you, for your time on behalf of the whole group that came today. We realize how precious your time is and appreciate it. Thanks.
Oh, thank you. And thank you to all of you who have come today, folks with Alzheimer's and caregivers. Thank you all so much. And I think Kate Walker would like to come and make some closing comments. As I said, I've been staying with Kate here in Salem with her husband, Lee. And Kate has arranged all of this. All these people who came here today, and I really appreciate that, Kate.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Dalto, committee members, thank you so much for this hearing. I'm a full-time caregiver for my husband, Lee. I have been full-time for 3 years. The other night I went shopping with a woman friend. It's the first time I'd been out without Lee in the evening for over a year. There are all kinds of problems. And you've heard some of them, and there is a lot of information in your folder about Alzheimer's and how much it costs. The average cost now for a facility for Alzheimer's is $41,000 a year. The average cost just to take care of the respite care is $12,000, all of which comes out of your own pocket. I really want to thank everyone who participated. We've been in the research with Dr. Quinn and his staff, and they're just wonderful, loving, caring people who do as much as they can. And I'd like to thank the caregiver and everyone else who spoke. And in a way, I want to thank people, caregivers who have Alzheimer's, who've struggled. There's a better day coming. I just know it. And I really want to thank my husband, Lee, who is the inspiration behind my passion to do something for Alzheimer's for all of us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you all. And especially thank you Chair Dalto for allowing us to have this time today to bring these folks here to bring the information about Alzheimer's disease. Thank you.
Yeah, why don't you start with that?
Well, I think that's been a productive session, and hopefully we'll have some more work that'll come out of this for education and making that difference to moving towards the better day. So that's very exciting, very encouraging. And I, college, just wanted to take a moment. We will close the informational meeting on the Alzheimer's program, and I just wanted to take a moment to welcome our newest member of the House Committee on Health and Human Services, Mr. Kevin Cameron, who is joining us from the 19th District in South Salem. And we really look forward to having you on this committee, and we think that you will hit the ground running and be able to contribute to our program in health and human services. So welcome. Do you want to say a word or two?
Well, I'm with Dr. Brain a little way. Just slow down so I can get my hands around everything. It's great to be here, and an honor and privilege to be serving with the rest of you and not only the full body but on this committee.
Well, we're glad to have you, Representative Cameron, and you are very fortunate in that this is a terrific, terrific panel. We have every single last member here is an experienced member of this legislative assembly. We have a great group, and we cover a lot of ground, so you're going to have to keep up with us, and we're happy to have you. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2254, and I'll ask Sandy to reintroduce us to House Bill 2254.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2254, as you may recall, we had a public hearing on February 2nd on the bill. This bill modifies the definition.
We'll stand at ease for a moment. Is back to order, and staff was reacquainting us with House Bill 2254.
Thank you. And again, Mr. Chair, this bill, 2254, was a legislative housekeeping bill which modifies the definition of child care facility for the purposes of obtaining liability insurance coverage. There was, if you might recall, that Bruce Bishop came forward with an amendment request to be attached for the psychiatric children's facilities that did not fit with the relating to clause, and we will be speaking to that in another fashion later on. We have an LC with that concept as an independent bill, but that's forthcoming.
Great, thanks very much.
So, Chair,
yes, Representative.
The House Bill 2254 originates and emanates out of LC 91. This has nothing to do then with LC 3083, dated 2-17-05.
That's correct. LC 3083 was drafted on behalf of this committee as a separate. A separate piece of legislation to accomplish the amendment that Mr. Bishop was trying to accomplish.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that clarification, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Chair, we're in work session?
Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair, I move 2254, House Bill 2254, to the House with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2254 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair, do we need to first approve the amendment?
There is not an amendment.
An amendment.
We attempted to do an amendment. It wasn't possible to include in this bill because of the subject matter, and so that amendment has actually been drafted as a separate bill.
Got it. Thank you.
So this is just a housekeeping measure.
Thank you.
Is any further discussion? Seeing no discussion, is there any opposition? Anybody opposed? Seeing no opposition, we will send House Bill 2254 to the floor. And do I have a motion to place that bill on the consent calendar?
So move.
Representative Butler moves that we place House Bill 2254 on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? House Bill 2254 is placed on a consent calendar. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2254 and open a work session on House Bill 2251. And staff will introduce this measure to us.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, again, House Bill 2251 was a housekeeping request from Legislative Council. This is repealing an obsolete definition of a severely disabled person. You may recall that Doug McKean came forward and spoke of a series of statutes that were in place that did not get carried on into a program. That we had a bill, Senate Bill 274 in 1999, that was expanding employment program that did not make it all the way through the assembly at that point. Prior to the 1999 session, in anticipation of 99, they had repealed statutes in preparation for the program, leaving just this one aspect of a definition. It is now in statute, just kind of standing alone for no apparent reason. They just want to get it off the books. Now, you do have a document that was submitted in opposition from the Disabilities Commission. And it was my understanding that there would be somebody from the commission here, but I don't see them. And that's just additional information for your records.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Question, staff. Sandy, the Disabilities Commission does not want the definition deleted. However, from what you've told us, that there is this piece of definition for severely disabled persons stands alone. Somehow the Oregon Disabilities Commission is concerned that if we take it out, that we're not going to serve the people. What's your understanding of why it should stay if we are serving the people and we are defining and assisting people with severe disabilities under other legislative statutes and other legislative mandates? I'm having trouble, I guess, finding out why we should leave something in which does nothing in the code, the Oregon Revised Statutes, if we're addressing the issues and addressing the concerns of the people in other places. I guess in that regard, did they really understand what they were in opposition to?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in conversations that I've had with the representative of the Disabilities Commission, I've not gotten a clear answer on that, and I know other folks in the disabilities community have chatted with them. Again, I don't have a direct answer for you, sir.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I would state further that they're concerned about budget cuts and staffing changes and the other adverse impacts to the disabled. Merely leaving a dangling participle out there in the code in the statutes that says let's define severely disabled individuals or a severely disabled person. But where their issues are being addressed in another place, I don't see that this letter of opposition really stands to do anything other than just prolong the issue of basically decoying the real issues. And I think it would be an assistance to the Oregon Disabilities Commission and the people that they serve if we were to remove this obsolete definition statute of a severely disabled person.
Thank you, Representative Butler. You know, I think the bottom line here is that we don't need to go into a discussion about whether or not they understand or don't understand what this bill is doing, because that's always subjective. And I think the key with their statement is to repeal the definition of, quote, severely disabled persons is a sign of abandonment, not inclusion. I don't think that's what this bill is trying to accomplish at all. As Representative Butler rightly pointed out, this is an obsolete piece of reference to law that for a program that doesn't actually exist. And there are a multitude of areas in state law and multitude of programs within the executive branch that serve severely disabled persons and assist them to get employment. In fact, we've heard on several occasions presentations from vocational rehabilitation folks within the Department of Human Services. So I'm having trouble understanding what the nature is of the concern. So having said that, I'll entertain a motion.
I would move that we move House Bill 2251 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2251. 2251 to the House where they do pass a recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Do we have any, maybe it's too late at this point, but do we have anybody in the audience who is willing to speak to the Disabilities Commission on this?
Well, Representative Tomei, we had indication that somebody was going to appear from the Disabilities Commission, but they didn't show today, and so we don't have anybody, and we don't really think that you know, the disabilities community as a whole opposes this bill, and I would say that if they really opposed this, they might have been here today to let us know, and maybe we could have reconsidered, but I don't see them here today, so... Is that responsive?
That's responsive, but I think I'm going to choose to vote no on this just because I would like to talk with somebody from the commission before I vote yes, and I may be changing my vote on the floor, but I think at least today I will be voting no.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Butler calls for the question. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative
Hammond? Aye.
Representative
Greenlee?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
No.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Representative
Dalto? Chair votes aye. House Bill 2251, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Do we have a carrier for this bill? Anyone? I guess the chair will carry. There being, excuse me. Yes. One final order of business, just very quickly, colleagues. We have distributed. We're going to look at introducing a committee measure. You have distributed before you legislative concept 3083, which is the amendment that Bruce Bishop was bringing forward to provide some clarification on the psychiatric intensive day treatment services. Have you had a chance to just review briefly this legislative concept for the purpose of introduction as a committee measure, colleagues?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Bruce Bishop did meet with us at a previous meeting regarding the concern and the attempt to go ahead and use the relating clause on 2254 for the purposes of seeking the introduction of language which has been presented to us in LC 3083. I would move that we bring forward LC 3083 and as a committee as a committee bill before the for introduction.
Thank you, Representative Butler, very much. Representative Butler moves that the committee take up LC 3083 for introduction as a committee measure. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there anyone opposed to the motion? Seeing no opposition, the motion carries. Legislative concept 3083 is adopted as a committee bill. Seeing no other business coming before this committee, we will adjourn the hearing. Okay.